Investing Simplified is brought to you by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisory firm. Price Financial Group has been doing estate planning since 1970 and investment and retirement planning since 1975. Individual situations may vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual professional advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Investing Simplified is the longest-running live financial program with a certified financial planner, estate planning attorney, and a certified public accountant to answer your questions for free. Got a tough estate, tax, or financial problem keeping you up at night? You can call the show right now at 503-222-9700. That's 503-222-9700. Long-distance and podcast listeners can call toll-free at 800-344-5836. Coming to you live from Portland, Oregon, and broadcast on affiliated stations throughout the Pacific Northwest. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Bo Caldwell.
We do Investing Simplified.
Welcome into Investing Simplified. However you're tuning in today, thanks for making us a part of your day. A reminder, if you miss the live show or you miss portions of our show, you can tune into iHeartRadio, Apple iTunes, Google Play, wherever you get your podcasts from. We do rebroadcast the show as a podcast. If you do listen on one of those mediums, please give us a like, give us a review. It helps us to get the show out to more people. So I am Bo Caldwell, CFP, here in office with the tax animal who's come out of hibernation a little bit, Kevin Stege. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Bo.
So Kevin's in today for his token monthly appearance during tax season. So how's tax season going so far?
Oh, it's getting going.
Getting ramped up?
It really starts back in December for, all the year-end planning and
sure.
and even in January, even though stuff's not coming in, people haven't received all their stuff. There's a lot to do.
Well, that's a good question. I've gotten that a couple of times. Generally speaking, for folks that are out there, when should they start to expect those year-end documents, those 1099s? Is there a time period that they have to be released? How does that all work?
Yeah, there's deadlines for each different type of form. W-2s have one set, and of course, the 1099s mm-hmm. that come from brokerage accounts, you guys have extended due dates that basically compresses our filing season into about one day. Thanks to your lobby.
Well, you said you guys, like I'm doing it.
Yes, you are. No, anyway, it depends on the investments people are in.
Yeah.
And it's understandable. I mean, if you're invested in a complicated business, a business can't just turn around net income to its shareholders in a week or two. I mean, many of these businesses need extensions and stuff, so it can be complicated.
Well, and it bears repeating. If you have a brokerage account with your financial advisor, if you're going to get a 1099, we get that question all the time about people that say, when is my 1099 coming? And, your advisor most likely isn't controlling that. It's the custodian, whoever has the funds. And the big thing to remember is if you own individual stocks, if you own REITs in particular, if you own business development companies or anything like that, they may be refiling because they may be changing a dividend to a return of capital. They may be changing some sort of gain distribution and a lot of that stuff. The reason they wait longer for that consolidated 1099 is to not have to issue a corrected one.
Yep. And that's what clients will get is brokerage firm to be in compliance, they'll issue a 1099 within the due date, but they'll also include a notice that says, most likely this is going to be corrected. So it's kind of a shell game.
Right. Well, and then it just complicates the situation for them with their accountant, too, because then they're saying, hey, I filed this, but now I've got to refile, and now I've got, So the thing about your 1099 is it should be coming, like we said, they have those deadlines towards the end of, I think was it February 3rd or February 5th or something like that, when they have to have at least the original one issued. If you have just retirement accounts and you haven't taken any money out, they don't issue the 1099, but when you do take out money, that's a simpler 1099, the 1099-R.
Yeah. Because that's just a report of the distributions you took and how much taxes were withheld.
Right. And a lot of people notice on there, just something that I've talked to people as we're talking through these 1099 issues, they say, I got my 1099-R and it says taxable amount not calculated, because a lot of times the custodians, whether that's your Fidelities or your TD Ameritrades, your Pershing, your Schwabs, they don't actually do the tax calculation. So they just say it's 100% taxable, and that's for you and your accountant to, you know, to figure what's taxable and what's
yeah,
not. Right?
That's right.
Yeah. And if you've done a Roth conversion, which we've talked a lot about Roth conversions over the last, you know, few weeks and months, if you've done a Roth conversion in 2019, you will get a 1099-R for that as well. And that's a big taxable event. And I wanted to cover some of that. And it's great that you're on today because people ask that question about what the amounts of money we can convert from Roth. And I've gotten a couple of follow-ups from last week's questions that were Roth conversion amounts. The maximum you can convert from traditional to Roth is your whole traditional. It just could be a poor tax decision if you're converting a couple $100,000 in 1 year.
That's right.
But the big reason you keep an eye out for the maximum is not the $6,000 or $7,000. That's the contribution limit to your Roth or to your traditional IRA. The maximum you can convert is how much income you want to pay. And if you're in your mid to late 60s and you're taking you're on Medicare at this point, that's another consideration to think about. Is if you get too high in income, even if you're willing to pay the tax, then your Medicare premium goes up. So that's a big thing to pay attention to. The other question I wanted to cover that talks about if we're talking about Roth conversions, the difference between converting individual stocks in a Roth conversion. We've talked before, have a listener who called in who's invested heavily in marijuana stocks, and they had sort of a pullback this last year, and he and I talked specifically about this being a good time to convert from traditional to Roth because he likes the stocks. He thinks they're going to rebound. He follows the industry, and he sees a lot of upswing in there, but they're at a low point right now. And so he gets to convert at a lower point or converting at a discount. You're converting, when you convert individual stocks, you're not converting the cost basis. You're converting whatever the fair market value is. And so that's what you pay the taxes on. So if you have a stock that you like the company, you think it's going to go great places, but it's down for whatever reason this last year, converting it now is a good time, right?
Yeah, if you're in a decent tax bracket, yeah.
So then if you convert it and then it grows, now it's in the Roth and it grows, and now you've gotten all that appreciation without having to pay the higher tax limit on it. But if you have a highly appreciated stock, say you bought Apple a couple years ago, and over the last couple years it's just gone like gangbusters, if you convert it now, you convert it for whatever that fair market value is, not its basis.
That's right, yeah. And just as a reminder, you know, the main benefit of a regular IRA is you get to, or a 401k or retirement accounts, is you get to make earnings on money you would otherwise have paid in taxes. But instead that money is in your account and you're getting to make the earnings over the course of 10, 20, 30 years. Mm-hmm. And then the other idea is then when you pull your money out, you're hopefully pulling it out in a lower tax bracket than when you deferred it way back when.
Right.
And so those are the two things to look at. If you're going to be in a higher tax bracket, you don't want to recognize that income, but wait until you're in your lower years.
Right.
And then, of course, there's always a planning point when to take Social Security, because when you pull money out, you know, if you're on PERS or something and maybe your spouse is pulling Social Security, most likely your Social Security is going to be fully taxable already because of, a nice pension.
Right.
And so that doesn't factor in. But for some people, doing a conversion before, you know, after retirement in a lower income year, but before you start taking Social Security, if you can, you know, do some planning around there, it can be some significant tax savings.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a caller on the line. TJ has a question about medical deductions. Hello, TJ.
I had a question about, I work at a pharmacy, and this time of year, all day long, people are wanting a printout or their statement for what they paid last year for the prescriptions. But I'm kind of curious, out of all these people that are getting printouts, I mean, what percent of people are actually able to deduct those expenses? Because I can't imagine, I think the deduction is like you have to exceed 10% of your adjusted gross income.
Yeah, very good question. And this is probably one of the areas that frustrates me the most is the amount of time and effort that taxpayers across the U.S. are spending to catch these nickels and dimes. It's 7.5% is the AGI limit. It was 10%, but they dialed it back for 2018. 2018 it was 10%, but they actually retroactively made it 7.5%. So we may even have some tax returns to amend because of it. But you're absolutely right. These medical expenses have to exceed 7.5% of the taxpayer's adjusted gross income for there to be any benefit. A lot of people are using the standard deduction now, a huge amount of people. I believe it's maybe 20% itemized, or maybe even less than that. That's just off the top of my head. And however, Oregon does have a lower standard deduction. And so if somebody does exceed the 7.5%, their medical may be beneficial in their Oregon return at 9%. So, you know, you buy a $100 prescription, you get a $9 write-off on your taxes. It's a lot of chasing around for $9. And then just a side note, Oregon does have their special medical deduction. But once you've exceeded $1,800 per taxpayer and or spouse, you've maxed that out already. And Medicare typically or you know, any insurance is going to max that out already out of pocket. So very good question, TJ. Your frustration is shared with me. So we're now a team.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for your call, TJ. That's a good, you know, that's a good question about it, you know. So if you are thinking of saving the receipts or going in and getting those printouts and stuff, make sure that you talk to your, you know, your CPA or your accountant first to see if it's worth your time and effort, if you're going to be able to qualify, right?
That's right. And, you know, my frustration stems from, you know, sitting across the desk from somebody who is, you know, advanced in age, not well in health, doing, you know, and they're sitting here trying to chase around for $15, $20 medical receipts because they're on a very limited income. They don't need to be spending time on that. Let's, right. And I will take this time to make a pitch to the state of Oregon to raise, I'm not saying lower taxes, but raise the standard deduction. Find a tax neutral way to raise the standard deduction in Oregon so that the simplification that happened on the federal level, where most people can itemize, most people can take the standard deduction. Let's get those same people taking a standard deduction in Oregon somehow so that we can really simplify the tax system.
Well, that, you know, that fits in right with the show's title, right? Investing Simplified.
That's right.
Taxes Simplified. And it would help save taxpayers' cost at the when they go visit with their professionals.
Absolutely.
As well, right?
Absolutely. We're still having to itemize. Nothing's changed in terms of the amount of time we have to spend with our clients. If Oregon would raise the standard, now we could simplify a number of tax
right.
returns.
Right, and it makes it easier for that pre-tax calculation for them as well to say, okay, well,
that's right.
A lot of people can use that 24, what's it, 24-4 now because it's gone up, right?
That's right.
But 24-4 is a rule of thumb to figure out what my standard deduction is going to be, but they can't do that in Oregon. They have to add it all up and keep all the receipts mm-hmm. and stuff like that, which mm-hmm. can make it more difficult and just cause you a headache when you go to meet with your professionals. So that's a good spot to, you know, to break, I think. But if like Kevin, you want to have that standard deduction in Oregon, make sure you call your representative, send an email that, you know, I think we could get that started. I think that everybody can agree that simplifying taxes in Oregon, you're not talking about raising or lowering taxes, just simplify it. Let's make it easier on everybody.
God forbid we would lower taxes.
Sorry.
Okay.
Right. We'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
Are you concerned about your retirement income? Do you really understand how your Social Security benefits work? Price Financial Group Wealth Management has helped many seniors in Oregon and Washington maximize their Social Security benefits at retirement through using their Social Security Seminar on Demand. Now you can watch this valuable information in the comfort of your home by just going to www.pfgwm.com and click on the free Social Security Kit. If you are serious about your retirement planning, you cannot afford to miss this opportunity. After all, you have invested your hard-earned dollars into Social Security all your working years. So shouldn't you get the maximum return you can get from those dollars? The future can be scary, and without a plan, it can be even scarier, especially when facing the unknown. What you don't know can hurt you. Get your free Social Security Kit at pfgwm.com or call 503-253-3000.
You're listening to Investing Simplified. Now, back to Bo Caldwell.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified. If you're just now tuning in, thanks for joining us. If you've been sticking with us over this first 15 or 20 minutes, we really appreciate you being here. As a reminder, you can listen at investingsimplifiedradio.com. You can also ask questions there if you don't feel like calling in, but If you do have a question, pick up the phone, give us a call. We'd love to answer, like TJ, if you have a question about medical deductions, anything and everything under the sun that concerns your financial life. Kevin and I are here to answer those questions. I did have a question that came in via text and answered it briefly on the text line, but it was a question about Social Security and getting spousal benefits on Social Security. And a common confusion that people have is the difference between the spousal benefit for Social Security, full retirement age benefit, and the survivorship benefit. And so the big things are, if you have a spouse that hasn't worked, or I should say was grossly underpaid for their work, so usually the spouse that stayed home and raised the kids has been grossly underpaid for,
that's right,
for the work that they've done, they do qualify under your record for a spousal benefit. And the big thing that happens is your full retirement age benefit, it's often abbreviated as FRA, right? Your full retirement age, which for folks that are turning 66 right now, because they're born in 1954, that's 66 years. That's their full retirement age. For folks like Kevin and I, it's 67, as of right now, right? That's our full retirement age. And so a lot of people know if you take your full retirement age benefit, that's where you can continue working and get the full amount. It continues to grow if you continue to defer it till age 70. And if you take it before your full retirement age, it's going to be a permanently reduced benefit. A lot of people know those basic rules. But the spousal benefit that they qualify for, your spouse qualifies for, is 50% of your full retirement age benefit as long as they take it after their full retirement age. If they were to take that spousal benefit before their full retirement age, it's reduced, just like yours is reduced if you take your benefit before full retirement age. Now, the common confusion happens is folks will say, well, I waited till 70 and got my 8% per year return plus the cost of living adjustments, and I'm getting significantly more. Why is my spouse not getting 50% of that? Because the spousal benefit does not continue to increase as you wait. It just is based on your full retirement age benefit. So if you have waited and taken that spousal, taken your benefit later as a higher benefit, your spouse still only gets 50% of your full retirement age as soon as they reach full retirement age. Now, there used to be some switch strategies, some things you could do, you know, a bunch of different ways to move around. The Bipartisan Budget Act back in 2015 basically threw an axe in a lot of those. But the one thing it didn't change was what's called survivorship benefits. So if you're saying, well, why would I wait if my wife or my husband isn't going to get to go up in their benefit based on me waiting? What they do get to go up in is the survivorship benefit or the widow's benefit. So if you wait till age 70 to take your Social Security and then you pass away, because if you're significantly older than your spouse, that oftentimes is what happens, or just as men, we live shorter lives than our wives, right? So if you're married and you have waited till age 70, then you pass away, your spouse then gets grossed up to your benefit that you took. So your widow's benefit is based on when you take your Social Security. So that's the big affect that happens if you don't wait or you do wait on your benefit. If you take your benefit early, your spousal benefit is still your wife's or husband's spousal benefit is still based on your full retirement age benefit. So the timing of yours doesn't affect the spousal, but it does affect the widow's benefit. That's a big confusing point, and actually oftentimes Social Security folks don't know that. And then the big thing is when you call Social Security or if you go in to see Social Security, they're not legally allowed to tell you about the different things, the different ways that you can wait. They're allowed to tell you, how do you get your maximum benefit today if you file today, right? So they'll say, hey, if you file today, this is what you get. This is how we can maximize that for you. And they are allowed to tell you, hey, if you roll back your benefits till 6 months ago, we can give you a lump sum check for the last 6 months. Oftentimes, that's not a good idea because that means you're permanently reducing your paycheck, right? And it's hard to look $25,000 in the mouth and they say, here's a $25,000 check, but because that's 6 or 10 months, maybe that's a year's worth of benefits and now you're permanently reducing yours. So it may or may not make sense. So if you go into Social Security and they tell you those things, make sure you call your advisor, call your CPA, call one of your professional advisors to make sure that you're making the right decision for you. And if you want to have a free, you know, we have that on, you know, on that lead-in at Price Financial Group Wealth Management. We're happy to give you that Social Security maximization report. If you come in and sit down with us and we'll say, hey, here's how we can maximize the amount of money that you're getting out of Social Security. And that may mean, how do we get you the biggest paycheck now? But it also means, how do we get the biggest bucket of money over time, right? So if you know your folks lived it well into their 90s, maybe you had a grandmother that lived in, you know, to over 100. You probably have a lot of longevity in your future, and that will make a difference too. So we can take that gray area about when do I file, when do I turn my benefits on, when do I turn my spouse's benefits on, and just give you a black and white, here's what that would mean for you. And you can make an informed decision. So give our office a call, 503-253-3000, or drop me an email, bo@pfgwm.com, if you'd like us to run that for you. Basically, we'll need to know, you know, where you are, where you're at tax-wise, where you're at Social Security projection-wise, and we can give you that maximization report and tell you how this looks.
Well, you, I didn't know you were such a Social Security guru. Good stuff. There's so many different what-ifs and scenarios,
yeah.
But just a real general question. What's the earliest somebody can start claiming on spousal and or widows?
Yeah, so the early, they're different, right? Mm-hmm. So the earliest you can claim on the spousal benefit is 62, but your spouse has to have claimed. So they have to be on Social Security in order for you to claim your spousal benefit. And 62, just like regular benefits, the earliest that you can claim. Now, interestingly enough, that also applies if you've been married 10 years and a day and have since been divorced and you have not remarried, you still can claim spousal on your former spouse's record, and it does not affect what they do or how they do it or their benefit. So that's the big question people have too. If I take 50% of my husband's, does that reduce his benefit? Or if I take 50% of my ex-wife's, does her benefit get reduced?
Nope.
It doesn't. The spousal benefit is there for you either way. So if you've been married for 9 years and 6 months, hold on for another seven. No, just kidding. No, if for whatever reason your marriage didn't work out and you were married for more than 10 years, you can still qualify for a spousal benefit. The other one is the widow's benefit. That can start as early as age 60. So if you're a qualifying widow, you can start as early as age 60 to claim on your deceased spouse's benefit. The other big thing that comes with that is that is the one switch strategy that's still around. So if at age 60 you turn on your widow's benefit, you can continue to let your own benefit grow till age 70 and then switch to your own benefit if that would be higher. So if you have the silver lining, you know, in the terrible storm that is losing a spouse like that, is that the widow's benefit is available there for you. And you can start taking it as early as age 60. It is reduced, right? Just like it would be not taking it at full retirement age. But you get to at least have some income coming in, and you can switch to your benefit later. So a lot of times that helps if, you know, heaven forbid you lose your spouse at when you're both 59 or 60, and the plan was to continue working for, you know, several more years. And that's the other thing about the widow's benefit. The income limits, you know, are different. It's not like the spousal or your original Social Security, and you're still working. So, so it's a lot of moving parts is the point, is if you have those situations, you know, come down and see someone.
Exactly. I don't like to talk about other people's dirty laundry, but when Kobe was going through some of his troubles, his wife held on for 10 years, and just shortly after that 10-year threshold, the divorce plans kicked into place. Fortunately, they were able to reconcile, and I'm glad to see that.
Right.
But I kind of wonder if there wasn't some financial planning underneath.
Yeah, thought process.
Yeah. Probably got advice from her. And there's probably, I'm sure Social Security wasn't a big item on her mind, but I think there's other 10-year threshold was probably big for that.
Yeah, I would imagine. Like you said, we don't want to, you know, air other people's dirty laundry or encourage, you know, in any way encourage any sort of marital issues, but they do exist. And the good news is too that you know, especially for those spouses that did get grossly underpaid for the work that they did for forever, and then somehow the marriage doesn't work out, you still get to, you know, have that spousal benefit that's built in there from Social Security. Now, unfortunately, if you didn't make it 10 years plus, you don't get to, or if you get remarried, that's the other thing.
Yeah.
So then you're now qualifying on your new spouse's record instead of your old spouse's record.
That's right. Yep.
But so if you have a Social Security question, give us a shout. Like Kevin said, the big question that comes in with Social Security and when to turn it on is that tax question, right? So a lot of people don't realize, and it's sort of, I don't know, it bugs me. I don't mind paying my fair share of taxes. We've talked about this. I don't want to pay more. And I'd love to have taxes be reduced, but what really just kind of grinds my gears, and who knows, I'm 36 years old, so who knows when or if I'm going to have Social Security around, right? But what, you know, grinds my gears is we've paid, you know, we got this money pulled out of our paychecks, and we pay taxes on it because we're gross income, we're paying taxes on it, right? And then now when it comes back out, when we take the Social Security, if you hit that income threshold, which are pretty low, it's something like 36,000, I think for, you know, for individuals at like 43 for married couples, something like that, where now 85% of my Social Security check is now taxable income. That seems crazy.
Mm-hmm. It is.
But I mean, that's how it is. But
Yeah.
So that's a big consideration when you're taking Social Security, like Kevin said, is, you know, if do we take Social Security, turn it on now, or do we wait and let it grow till maybe you're in a lower tax bracket because maybe you had a severance package, or, you know, or if we're doing conversions to Roth, if we can spend some time converting your traditional assets to Roth, then turn on the Social Security when all your income is Social Security and Roth distributions, which are tax-free, then maybe that would make sense to push it out longer.
Yeah. So you're a little more optimistic than me. You're assuming that you're actually going to be collecting a Social Security check.
Yeah.
No, I'm not that pessimistic, but, you know, we're, you and I, well, no, I'm relying on the millennials to keep working to, fund my Social Security. We'll see about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's several different ways, and I did a workshop about this, you know, a couple months ago, that there are several different ways that it could be fixed, and it's really easy.
It just
takes them getting off their tuchuses and you know, fixing it.
Yeah, tweaking up the full retirement age to tweaking up the maximum income level that Social Security is withheld on. I think it's somewhere around 130,000.
I think you're right. 130 something.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, if they raise that, and it makes sense to raise it because it's the more affluent people that, you know, it's people making, you know, if someone makes 500,000 and only the first 130,000 they're paying Social Security on,
right,
you know, 140 isn't going to hurt them too much.
Right. Yeah. And I've seen projections where you don't have to raise it that much. I mean, obviously if they just uncapped it, then it would be fully funded, but you know, that's not happening obviously, but I don't think they have to raise it. I saw one of the projections I did, and it's math that is above my head, right? Where they're looking at all the things and all the information that I don't have. But I think, you know, that what I saw was like 220 or something like that, which is, you know, that's a significant increase, but not in the grand scheme of things is not that much. And it wouldn't affect, you know, it's not going to affect 95% of the people, right? Because they're 95% or whatever is still under the threshold anyway. So it just affects, like you said, the more affluent, but that would help to fix that if you, like you said, raise the retirement age. A lot of people don't realize, so, you know, when FDR created Social Security, 65 was the life expectancy. And that's why that was full retirement age for Social Security. And the funny thing, you know, I make a joke about FDR said, this is never going to be taxed in my lifetime. And it was like right after he died that then Congress passed the, you know, now Social Security is taxable. But it...
Interesting.
It's one of those things that, you know, they're coming after, like with the Secure Act, where they felt like, hey, we're not getting our pound of flesh that we want. And so now let's figure out a way to get our pound of flesh.
And of course, the age old issue is you know, you fix one program, government's going to have a way of screwing something else up and then needing to raise taxes somewhere else. So it's a dog eat dog world there.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, like expecting the government to get something right is, you know, what's the definition of insanity, right? Is repeating the same action and expecting a different result.
Yep.
Yeah, and it, you know, the planning for Social Security planning is extremely important, you know, if you're approaching that age, and you know, it's fully funded through I think 2033 and then or 2034, and then it's, you know, 75% funded for, you know, in perpetuity after that. So there are tweaks that they'd have to make, and I don't foresee them stopping Social Security. I mean, how many folks do you know that's their primary source of income? So not just the whole, you know, almost Civil War aspect of cut that out, where you got this, you know, everyone's going to be up in arms about it. But the additionally, how that would do, you know, crazy damage to the economy. All those folks that are on, you know, fixed income that are on Social Security, they're spending money, right? They're putting money back into the system. And if you take that, their only paycheck away, it'll be a big deal.
Yeah. The event horizon date of 2033 on this is getting closer and closer. It's used to seem like a long ways away, and now it's like they haven't bumped that date down. So apparently they've factored in a lot of these changes in income growth and inflation and all that. And that date has roughly stayed the same for, you know, when Social Security isn't fully funded anymore. And so we'll see what happens in the next decade.
Right. Right. Yeah. You know, who knows? It's one of those things like we don't know what's going to happen. But at least if you are approaching that date, if you're, you know, really close to Social Security date and you would like to get that analysis, like to do that maximization report, give us a shout. We're happy to do it for you. And, you know, it's always with that caveat of we don't know what the government's going to change about the laws. But as of right now, this is how we do it. So with that, we're going to take another break here and we'll be right back. And I think we'll do Tax Investigator next segment if that works for you, Kevin. Yeah, that works great. All right. So tune back in. We've got some Tax Investigator updates. Give us a call. 503-222-9700 if you have your own question. We'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
Legal matters are never easy, but they are especially difficult when they involve the most important people and aspects of your life. This is Taylor Cattell, founding partner of KG Law Group. It's important to have an attorney who cares about your unique circumstances and knows how to get the outcome that is best for you. At KG Law Group, we specialize in estate planning and family law, including wills, trusts, powers of attorney, guardianship, and divorce. At KG Law Group, we provide both expertise and compassion as we guide you through the complex legal landscape. We balance knowledge of the law with exemplary client service. Whether you're reacting to a crisis or planning for the future, we are here to help. If you need legal advice, give us a call today and schedule a consultation at 503-878-8948. That's 878-8948. Or visit us online at kglawgroup.com. That's kglawgroup.com, serving Oregon and Southwest Washington. KG Law Group, your family, your legacy.
Here's your opportunity to ask Kevin Stege, CPA and shareholder of the Baker Colson CPA firm, that tax question that's been keeping you up at night. You can call Kevin, 503-417-9595. Or toll free at 877-733-1011. Now, here's the CPA with the tax answers, Kevin Stege.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified, and disregard those numbers on that pre-recorded.
The imaging.
Yes, we will get that updated here fairly soon, as we have with the rest of the imaging. And we're going to talk on the Tax Investigator. We are going to talk about trust and estate taxation. I want to give you some good details on it, kind of give you some trivia that you'll win at any of parties and stuff. But before that, we've got some callers.
Yeah. So it looks like Henry's on the line with a question about Social Security. Hello, Henry.
Well, hi there, Bo. Just make this quick. My wife and I are both on Social Security, and is it correct that when one of us passes away, the higher amount of the Social Security that we're receiving would remain and the smaller amount would go away?
That is correct. Yep. So if you if you pass away and you have the higher Social Security amount, then she would get grossed up to your amount, or vice versa. If she's the one with the higher one and she's the one who passes away, then you get grossed up to hers. Yep, you keep the higher one. They make it more complicated than it is, but simplified. Yep, you keep the higher one and the lower one goes away.
And I assume that takes paperwork to file.
Yeah, you got to call them and let them know. Yeah, nothing gets done with the government agencies without paperwork.
Oh, okay, thank you.
You betcha, Henry. Great question. Thanks so much. So then looks like Harry has a question about a Roth IRA. Hello, Harry.
Yeah. Good thing you gave the new number. I will tell people the old number will not work. I had that programmed in. For some reason, I didn't program the new number. And so I tried calling, and then I got the station, and they had some other program that was going on.
Right.
So anyway, we kind of discussed this. I was converting my Roth to my regular to the Roth IRA. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And when I called my brokerage firm, they clarified something for me.
Sure.
And that was that the amount you convert over is tax-free, but any growth, I'm of the age, but any new growth is still subject to that 5-year thing. But the amount you convert over is tax free. Now, my new question is, does that continue all the time? That, say, 10 years down the road, if I put money in, the money I put in is tax free, but any growth in that is subject to that 5-year thing?
If you're talking about the conversion dollars, yeah, it's about the, and it's about the Roth being open for 5 years. So when you, in terms of contributions, but yeah, so, but yeah, the conversion dollars, I believe, and I'll have to clarify that, we'll check, but I believe no matter when you convert, the growth on the converted dollars is subject to the 5-year rule, but I'm not certain if that, I'm pretty sure that continues, but I'll have to look it up.
I'm not sure.
And that's new dollars as well?
Yeah, not if it's a Roth contribution, no. As long as the Roth been open for the 5 years, because remember, the contribution is different than the conversion.
Okay, but it has to be open for 5 years?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But there's no, doesn't start over. So let's say you contribute dollars, in 2 years from now, so you only have 3 years left till that Roth's been open for 5 years, right?
I see. Yeah, and because I did the initial thing on December 31st, mm-hmm, I only have 4 years now
to
wait.
Right, right.
Okay, thank you much.
Yeah, thanks. Great question, Harry. And good clarification on that. He brings up a really good point about the conversion and the 5-year rule.
Each conversion amount has its own 5-year period and must satisfy the 5-year period rule to avoid the 10% early withdrawal penalty.
Okay, there you go. So the each conversion
amount has its own 5-year period.
Okay, good to know. So yeah, so every conversion has a new 5-year, but like you say, in the contribution, it doesn't have the 5-year. It doesn't start over.
Exactly. Original contributions, once you've set up. In fact, that's a good planning point. If you've got kids and stuff like that, get them to put a few bucks into a Roth, get their original 5-year period on a standard Roth running, get that out of the way. And you've got a good tax planning tool.
Yeah. Even if you're just using a Roth IRA savings account at a credit union or at a bank, just to put, the caveat is they have to have earned income. So they have to have an earned income and have to be filing a tax return, but it can really help if you have, teenage kids that are getting their first job or they're in college working some, and even if you just throw $1,000 in there, to help match their income, and you can contribute that, it's a gift to your kid to contribute it for them as long as they earn money. So we also have Carol on the line who has an IRA Roth Medicare question. I'm assuming based on conversions, Carol.
Yes. Hello. Thank you.
Sure.
Let's say that this year I want to do a conversion. Mm-hmm. Of $20,000, how much will that raise my Medicare?
Well, okay, that's a very good question. It's dependent on your other income, and basically the conversion amount will get added into your income along with all of your other income, IRA distributions, brokerage accounts, Social Security and pension, and whatever other income you have. If that raises to the level of the Medicare thresholds, depending on your marital status, then it will affect your Medicare, the amount of your Medicare premiums.
Where do I look up the Medicare threshold table?
So you can, if you go to medicare.gov, they'll be able to find that. And I was just pulling that up just so that we can know I can give you just kind of a breakdown. But if you go to medicare.gov, or if you just Google, the Medicare Part B thresholds, but you can go, I just pulled it up right here, and it's medicare.gov/your-medicare-costs/Part B costs. But just Google Medicare Part B thresholds. But for an individual filing a tax return, then as long as you don't cross over the $87,000, if you're a joint return, as long as you don't cross over $174,000, you're still at that baseline. As soon as you go above that, and then it's tiered just like every other tax bracket, then you go up. It looks like it adds about $60 to $80 per month of cost each time you cross a new threshold.
So would deductions affect that $87,000 threshold as well?
No, this is income, just gross income.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So if you do not convert more money that raises you above the $87,000, you're good to go?
Yep. As long as you're below that $87,000 as an individual, then it won't raise your Medicare costs. But if you go above that, and that's the caveat to throw in there, and I had a client that brought that up the other day when we were talking about other income-related stuff, but she said, even if you go over by a dollar, then you go, ugh, right? Because it's, because then you just, one whole extra dollar on your income, and then now you're paying $200 a month for Medicare Part B instead of $144.
Well, thank you.
You betcha. No, that's a great question, Carol. And it's worth talking to your CPA or whoever does your taxes Just like Carol said, you may not know where those thresholds are. And again, while she was talking, I just went on the computer and Googled Medicare threshold.
Yep.
But if you go to Medicare.gov, they have all that sort of stuff.
Yep, that's right. And remember, it's a 2-year look back. So your 2020 Medicare charges that's withheld from your Social Security, it's based on looking back to your 2018 income. So what you do this year in terms of conversions, whatever your 2020 amounts are, that's going to affect your 2022 Medicare withholdings.
Absolutely.
So it's a bit of a delay, and they need that time to get everyone to get their tax returns in and stuff. So,
and that's notwithstanding the increases that they've been doing, like this last year when they did a $10 increase. Anyway, it's worth checking out when you're doing those conversions, when you're thinking about taking money out of your traditional IRA or your traditional 401k, whether it's a conversion or just a distribution, to notice how that's going to affect your Medicare costs if you're on Medicare, right? And so that brings up a good point. If you're 62, 63, if you're 63 years old and thinking about doing a conversion, be aware that when you go on Medicare, if you go on Part B, that's only if you go on Part B.
Mm-hmm.
So remember, with Medicare, you have to file for Part A within the 3 months before your birthday month, the month of your birthday month, or the 3 months after. But if you're still working or if you're covered by your spouse's plan, you don't actually have to file for Part B and start paying Part B premiums until you actually go on to Part B with Medicare. If you have Medicare questions, we also do have some folks that work here around town help folks get on to Medicare, help folks get on, make the decision between Medicare Advantage, Medicare supplements. It's a super complicated process, as all the government things are, but a lot of times people don't realize, if you work with someone who helps you get your placed with Medicare, get your policy placed with Medicare, whether that's a Medicare Advantage or, which is also called Part C, or a Medicare supplement, or just your prescription drug plan, which you have to enroll in. If you work with an agent who helps people with that, it doesn't cost you anything more. So it behooves you to talk to somebody who is familiar with that, who's an expert. I know enough to be dangerous about it, but not enough to help people actually make that decision.
The final decision, yeah.
Well, because it affects who your doctors are, where you can go to get care and all that sort of stuff. So those are great questions that kind of took up the segment. So I'd like to take a break and give you a whole thing to run on the Trust and Estate Planning Administration, because I think that's a good concept to have. And I like to have those trivia pieces for my for my cocktail party.
Sounds very good. We may or may not do it, because it is
it's pretty meaty.
It's pretty meaty.
Okay.
And I do have some very important clarifications on the regular to Roth 5-year set of rules, and I think we can really lay that out so you know where you stand on this.
I like that. I think that's a good plan. We want to make sure that we're given the correct information.
Yep, and we are. We did.
Yeah, good.
Yep.
Okay.
It's just more. More information.
More information is always better. So we're going to take our last break here, and we'll be right back with some more Investing Simplified. If you have a question about Roth conversions, like Carol and like Harry, if you have a question about Social Security, like Henry, give us a call, 503-222-9700. We'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Coulson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future, and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Coulson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We're located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercoulson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercoulson.com, 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Coulson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
You're listening to Investing Simplified. Now, back to Bo Caldwell.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified. Thanks for listening today. Thanks for tuning in. So, Kevin, we had some updates on the Roth conversion dollars, but we do have Dave on the line who has a question about a 529 plan. Hello, Dave.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
My question is, I've got a 529 plan for my, my grandkids, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously they're 5 years old and 8 years old. If I'm dead, where I've got a trust also, okay? Do I have to have this in my trust, or should I have it in my trust, or the ends that they're, you know, say I'm dead?
Yeah. Do you know, Dave, do you have a successor custodian on there, or, you know, a successor owner? Usually the way, unless the 529 plan is already in what's called a Uniform Transfer to Minors Act, UTMA or UGMA, depending on which state it was opened in, then it's not in a trust, but what happens is there's a successor owner that you put on there, and a lot of times what we advise people is to have the child's parent or just someone else that you trust to take care of it. You could name whoever the trustee of your trust as the successor owner of the assets in the 529 plan. So the 529 plan is laid out there. The kids are the beneficiaries of it. But in terms of putting it inside the trust, I wish Taylor was here, but I don't know what the implications are with that in terms of expected family contributions and then just the distributions from it. Because with a 529 plan, the big thing is you can change the beneficiary either vertically, you know, in terms of make right. the beneficiary the parent, or then if the grandkids don't end up going to the college, or they get full scholarships, you can let it ride for their kids, or you can move laterally, like to their cousins. So I don't know if putting it inside the trust takes that option away. That most of the time we'll have a successor owner on there, and so that way if something happens to you, the new owner takes over as owner, and the kids are still the beneficiaries of it, so it's still set aside for their education.
Okay, so basically the successor owner would be like my daughter then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's usually what people do, is have the kid's parent be, because we want you to be the owner of it, so it doesn't get counted in terms of if they're applying for financial aid. But you want it to be that a lot of times we'll have your daughter be the successor owner. That way, it's still laid out for the benefit of the two little ones.
Right. Okay. Well, that makes sense. I'll have to check and see. I don't remember anything about a successor owner, but
sure.
I got wondering about that. It doesn't sound like it has to be in the trust if I got mm-hmm. a successor owner.
Yeah, I don't believe it has to be, and it should be pretty easy. Are you, what state are you in, Dave?
Oregon.
Okay,
yeah.
And is it with? Are you? Do you have it with the Oregon College Savings Plan or with? Okay. Yeah. Yeah. But you can. If you give them a shout, they should have a form just to add a successor owner on there.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate
you betcha.
It.
That was a great question, Dave. So, Gary has a question about Social Security. Hello, Gary.
My question is: say a lady's been married twice. And each time it was over 10 years,
mm-hmm.
and both of the husbands that have passed away, can she collect on either one of them? Say if the first one had a higher Social Security than the second one?
That is a question I don't know the answer to. The widow's benefits are wonky. When she got remarried, was she over 59?
No.
Yeah, then I believe, and don't quote me on this, I'd have to look it up for you, Tim, but I believe the amount that she gets on the widow's benefit is based off her second husband. Because the widow's benefit, actually, you don't have to be married more than 10 years, you just have to have been married. But I believe because she got remarried before she turned 59, I believe that it's based off of that second spouse, I believe.
Oh, okay.
I don't know that for sure, but that's I believe that to be the answer. I will try to look that up.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you betcha. That was a great question, Gary. Because oftentimes people have multiple spouses. As far as I know, it's when you get remarried if you're a widow. With a spousal benefit, the 50% is whoever you're married to now. But if you get remarried, you can't claim on your first ex-spouses. You have to claim on the most recent spouse.
Okay.
But for the survivorship, it depends on you when you get remarried, I believe. Because if you get remarried after 59, you can still claim on your first spouse's widow's benefit. But I'll have to find out.
Gotcha.
So we also have Tim, who has another Social Security question. Hey, hello, Tim.
I'm a unique situation. I am turning 70 next month, mm-hmm. and my wife is 23 years younger than I am. Mm-hmm. So I have not claimed Social Security yet. I plan on doing so next month because I wanted to get that additional benefit.
Yeah.
She is now collecting, and my son is too. But I've got an 11-year-old son, and mm-hmm. she's getting a small amount under a special deal we had a few years back. I think it ended a few years ago. But if I should die after 70, am I right in understanding that she gets the full survival benefits? Does she also get that other benefit that my son and her get now? Do you know which one I'm talking
about?
I do.
Yeah, if you're on Social Security and you have a minor and you're still raising a minor child, yeah. She will not get the full widow's benefit until she turns 60. That's as early as she can take that. But there is a different benefit, like you're talking about, for being a widow still raising a minor child. So, yes, she will get the – and I don't know the exact amount of it. Again, I'd have to look up the exact rules because it's a complex situation. But you are correct in that there is another benefit. As long as it doesn't go above, there's a family maximum that is out there. So, having the minor child when you have a spouse who has passed away who qualified for Social Security, she would get that benefit, and that goes until – and actually, technically, the child is the one that gets the benefit, but usually the parents are the ones who administer it, right? But, that goes until your child turns 18, and then that turns off. But then by that point, I think if I did the math in my head, she should be nearing 60, in which case then she'll be able to turn on that survivor's benefit, which would be based on – that widow's benefit, which is based on – your Social Security that you're turning on now at 70, but if she turns it on early at 60, then it's reduced a bit, right? Like by, I think about 25%.
Okay. So if I die like next month after I've claimed this thing, and she's going to be only 48,
right.
I think, she would not get any survivor's benefit at all then.
No, she doesn't get, there's a death benefit that they pass out. It's a one time, it's like $400 or $500 that they send out because you passed away, but she doesn't get to go on the widow's benefit until she's old enough, but you would get that benefit that goes to the child because the child is still under 18.
Is a widow's benefit for her, would that be the same as what I would be getting at the time I die?
If she waits till full retirement age, yep. But if she takes it early, it's reduced at 67. It's reduced
67.
If she takes it at 60, which is as early as she can turn it on, it's reduced by, I think it's about 25%.
Okay. All right. I see. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, you betcha. That's a great question, Tim. And that's a common situation where folks have a much younger. So in his situation, waiting till 70 is great for that increased benefit, as well as that widow's benefit that'll be available to his wife when she gets to that point. So
that's right.
So we wanted to clarify
a
couple of things before we go here about the Roth conversion. Right?
Yeah, so, the five-year rule. Basically, remember, there's 2 5-year rules. One is for your own account that you're just directly contributing to your Roth. It's a one-and-done 5-year rule. Get that one out of the way as soon as you can, as young as possible. The second 5-year rule is for conversions from a traditional to a Roth. And that 5-year rule, there's a 10% penalty if you violate it. And this 10% penalty is only for people under 59 and a half. So with that said, if you're doing conversions over the age of 59, there is no 5-year rule for principal amounts or earnings. There's no 10% penalty on any of those conversions. It's only for people under age 59.
Right, right. And the only 5-year rule if you're over 59 and a half is if you convert 10,000 and now it's worth, let's just say the market has a great year, now it's worth 20. If you're still inside the 5 years, that growth is not tax-free, right? You have to wait 5 years for it to be tax-free.
I believe the growth, even the earnings.
Okay, interesting. Because I was always under the impression that the growth in there, you have to wait the 5 years, but
the 10% penalty is only for people under 59.
Right, right. Yeah, 10%.
And so even this is regarding only the 10% penalty.
Okay.
So no 10% penalty applies once you're over 59.
Right, 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 right. No, but I mean, because Roth distributions are tax free, right? But if you don't wait 5 years, the growth on it, I think, is still taxed like a regular IRA. It's not a penalty, it's just taxed like a rate. We'll find out. We'll talk about it next week to make sure. We'll clarify so we get you the right info. So if people have questions, Kevin, how do they get a hold of you?
Yes, 503-666-5569, and we are at baker-colson.com.
And just as a caveat to warn them, you are in hibernation, so it doesn't mean you're not listening. If they do reach out to you, you'll get back to them, even if it's not immediately.
You may get one of our other competent tax professionals.
Exactly. If you want to get a hold of me, it's 503-253-3000, or visit us on the web at pfgwm.com. We also had a caller that let us know you can call free Medicare counseling at 800-722-4134. I haven't vetted that, but that was from a listener. So thanks for listening to Investing Simplified. Hope you all have a great day. God bless y'all out there.
Price Financial Group Wealth Management.
Navigating through today's financial investment world can seem pretty scary. Now, here's the good news.
Chuck Price, president of Price Financial Group Wealth Management, introduces a new revolutionary concept that will change how you invest now and in the future. It's called Asset Lock. Asset Lock monitors your investment accounts 24/7, 365, and alerts you when action needs to be taken. And now, Chuck Price offers Asset Lock. At Price Financial Group Wealth Management, we believe all our clients deserve to have Asset Lock monitoring their accounts. So call Chuck today or online at pfgwm.com and learn how you can get Asset Lock on your accounts today for free. Price Financial Group Wealth Management, because the smart investor knows what you don't know can hurt you.
Investing Simplified.
Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. You can listen to past shows of Investing Simplified or sign up for our free newsletter at www.pfgwm.com. This show was brought to you by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 103, Portland, Oregon, 97216, 503-253-3000 or 877-50-PRICE. Investing Simplified is a registered trademark owned by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated.